and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and we're bringing you our feature interview followed by some new music from Ukraine. In this episode, Bohdan Nahailo is in conversation with art curator and gallery owner Miroslava Hartmand about what it was like growing up with a Ukrainian identity in the UK, and what it's like today running a gallery in Kyiv's historical center in the midst of Ukraine's rapidly evolving art scene. Have a listen.
Well, I'm delighted to have as my guest on this week's show Miroslava Hartmand, who is a curator, researcher, and writer. She runs the Triptych Gallery in Kyiv's famous Andriivsky Uzviz, which showcases both Ukrainian and international artists. Welcome to the show, Miroslava.
Hello, Bohdan, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's only because you have such a nice English accent. As someone born in England, you know, it's always a pleasure to hear a Ukrainian speaking with a proper English as opposed to some other accents that we have.
Absolutely.
Well, tell us a little bit first and foremost about yourself. How did you end up with this English accent?
Well, I was born here in Kyiv, but I moved to the UK with my father when I was very young. And actually, I grew up in Oxford and then London. I went to a girls-only school in sunny Surrey. And I decided to take a gap year after I finished school and college or sixth form.
Well, don't rush ahead. There's plenty of interesting material there. So you grew up in Oxford. Your father was what, a professor?
Well, he was at Worcester College doing a postdoc and also doing some teaching as well. But actually, he has since given up the academic life and he's now in the city in finance. So we moved to London.
But did you spend some years in Oxford?
I did, yeah. Actually, as a child, I learned to read in Oxford. So when I was about 5 and a half, so it's...
Must have been a great experience growing up among the ivory towers.
It really was a wonderful and magical experience, and I think it has spoilt me in so many ways. And when Philip Pullman's Northern Lights trilogy came out, lots of people used to say, "Oh, you're the little girl from the Northern Lights," because, you know, I was little and I was kind of roaming Worcester College, and sort of I was the token child in the college, and it was really great fun. That's also when I first saw Apple computers, because they had them at the MCR or Middle Common Room, and I was allowed to play on the Apple computers, which seemed like something out of the coming space age at the time. So it was both access to the old, you know, the architecture and the incredible atmosphere, but it was also, you know, the new resources, new technology that places such as Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, MIT, are so well known for.
But also the ethos, I suppose, the culture and the sophistication. Probably you were privy to some meetings with very clever people.
I went to St. Barnabas Primary School, which was sort of well known for having a really international contingent. And it was mostly kids of academics and visiting scholars. And I really had a fantastic primary school experience. It was very diverse. It was very accepting. The standards were really high.
As a Ukrainian, were you tempted at any stage to say, "Hey, I'm in Britain. I've got the best of this world. I'm going to be British from now on"?
Well, growing up in the UK, I was very aware of the fact that I was Ukrainian. It was something that was a huge part of my identity always. And, you know, it always started from the school register, right? When the teacher would call my name. And if it was a new teacher, they would really struggle with Miroslava. So, you know, I guess...
Well, let me interrupt. My father, great man that he was, in all his wisdom, named me Bohdan Nahailo, difficult enough, but he called my sister Yaroslava Lyubomira. Now imagine that, quite a mouthful, huh?
It's tricky.
An English group. So they ended up calling her Yari for short.
I think that's...
But Miroslava's not so bad. I mean, what do they call you, Miro?
Well, my friends have always called me Miro, and I go by Miro in the UK. But actually, I was
So you have a Miro image?
Something like that, yeah. But then, you know, my French and Spanish friends call me Miro, like the artist. So there's something to be said about that. So, you know, I had a lovely experience growing up in Oxford, but actually moving to London was the sort of the rude awakening, because I remember starting secondary school at Wallington Girls, which is a girls-only school in Surrey, which is predominantly predominantly English, sort of suburban, upper middle white. And that was a far less forgiving place. I remember on my first day at school when I was 11, I introduced myself to the girl sitting next to me. And she said, "Sorry, what? What's your name?" And she just couldn't pronounce it. And she turned to me and said, "I'm just going to call you It." So I kind of, you know, Ukrainians and generally speaking, Eastern Europeans have a really tough time in the so-called politically correct West.
I know all about it. I mean, my name is Bohdan Petro Nahailo. And at school, Sister Mary Patricius, the head of the school and nun, decided I would be Peter. Upon this rock, would build her claims to. So I was Pete, you know, instead of being Bohdan, because Bohdan was too difficult for them. Anyway, okay, so now you're in school, you get higher education at some stage.
Absolutely. So I was 14 when the Orange Revolution happened, and I was a huge history buff. I was really planning to either go on to become an historian or some sort of academic and in that sort of humanities area. And that's when the Orange Revolution happened. And
what was the impact of that one? We'll talk about Maidan later, but yeah. Orange.
So to me, being in London at the time, I think it was the first real sense that I got of belonging to a country that wasn't Russia. And I'll explain, because growing up in London in the sort of post-Soviet immigrant community amongst, you know, the other communities that we were part of, we were sort of, as Ukrainians, I guess we weren't quite so aware of our Ukrainian identity in the way that people who would have left during the Soviet times or before the Soviet times even would have been. So I grew up in essentially a trilingual family. So my father's British Ukrainian. We spoke Ukrainian, still do. My stepmother's Russian from Moscow. But my mother's Ukrainian and my stepfather is Russian from St. Petersburg. So we've always spoken both Ukrainian and Russian in the family. It was never an issue, and I never really vehemently identified as Ukrainian as opposed to sort of any other former Soviet republic. Like, we kind of felt like we belonged to the same sort of cultural and linguistic sphere, and we understood one another. So I guess the later, you know, the later comers really were part of that infrastructure of Russian-speaking culture.
Did you interact much with others from Ukraine or from Russia?
I did, actually. My teacher, Mikhail Sarny, at the Eastern Orthodox Cathedral School in London, in South Kensington, is from Kiev. And he used to tell me, so I went there from age, I think, 11 till about age 14, when I went into my goth and heavy metal phase and decided to renounce patriarchal structures. He told me that he used to dream about Kiev. Like, no matter how long he had spent in the UK, he used to always, like, in his dreams, he would find himself in Kiev, and he used to really, really miss it. And I didn't have a real sense of that. I didn't really miss Ukraine or miss Kiev. I missed my mother, and I missed my family.
You were probably too young when you left.
I suppose. I mean, I would visit all the time. Every school holiday, I would visit. So I never really had a sense of having left. I kind of knew that England was where I was based, and then Kiev was always somewhere I would come back to see family. I never really felt like there was a trauma or disconnection, not at all. But actually, it was the Orange Revolution when I saw, you know, my city and riot police and protesters putting flowers into the shields of the riot police on the front page of the Metro, which is a free newspaper that gets given out on the London Tube. When I saw Ukraine on the Metro front page, that's when I had a real sense of kind of cognitive dissonance, because because in a way, you're never really both here and there. You have to sort of, you know, your soul kind of has a footing somewhere. It has roots somewhere. And I just really realized that what I wanted to do more than anything was to spend time in Ukraine consciously as an adult and actually experience speaking Ukrainian, Russian every day. So I decided that after finishing school, I would take a gap year and go to Ukraine. And I did. So when I was 18, I moved to Kiev for a year, but I actually ended up staying for 4 years because I started university and I went to the Kiev National University's Institute of International Relations as an international student, which was quite an experience. And I studied international law, and it was a real chance for me to sort of get my Ukrainian, my emigre Ukrainian and Russian up to academic standard. And it was after that that I went back to Oxford to do my master's degree. And then, of course,
in what?
In international relations. And then, of course, the Revolution of Dignity happened. So again, I was sort of called back. And
was that a shock for you?
It was. The violence of it was a great shock. Everybody remembered, you know, the Orange Revolution as this great surge of youthful vigor. It was in many ways very theatrical. It looked great on TV. But of course, when the Euromaidan came, it did not look great on TV. Seeing, you know, dead bodies on Ukraine's main square, you know, that in a way was a very clear signal to me that the time that I spent during my undergraduate degree in Kiev was time well spent. Because
you'd already made your choice in terms of self-identification.
I always identified as British Ukrainian from a very early age.
All right. Now, let's jump ahead. Mm-hmm. That's the background, as it were. So how did you end up as a curator and running an art gallery here on one of the most famous streets of Kyiv? So, certainly a cultural streets.
During preparations for Euro 2012, Andriivsky Uzviz, or the Montmartre of Kiev, was under reconstruction. So a lot of the buildings, a lot of the shops, galleries on the street were sort of temporarily closed. And the previous owner put the gallery up for sale. So in 2012, my Ukrainian family here decided to invest in it. And the gallery was under management for almost 2 years. And then, of course, the revolution happened. So, you know, the previous working model was no longer tenable, and we were kind of faced with a choice: either shut the gallery down or have me running it. And the gallery has been there since 1988. It's one of the first Western-style contemporary art galleries in the former Soviet Union. And I kind of decided to rise to the challenge. And I kind of, you know, I'm like Mary Poppins. I go where I'm needed. So I came in August 2014 when, you know, we didn't know whether Russian tanks were going to start rolling into Kiev, whether Russian planes were going to start bombing us. But we knew that we had this gallery space in the cultural heart of Kiev to do something with. So it's taking me a little while, and we've rebranded to make it more inclusive. I mean, all the previous gallery programming was exclusively in Russian, and I decided to, you know, that we would run the gallery as a dual language space. So we'll have Ukrainian and English as our languages, you know, for all, everything that we print, everything we produce. And we started showing increasingly international artists, and, you know, I started doing something that I would call sort of cultural diplomatic exchanges. And that meant that actually we worked closely with the embassies, with the international organizations that were in Kiev to sort of to bring, you know, more international art into Kiev.
Okay, let me remind listeners, I'm talking to Miroslava Hartmann, a curator, researcher, writer, British-Ukrainian, but now spending a lot of time running her art gallery and working on other projects here in Kiev. Yeah, I suppose, you know, your this bilingual approach makes sense. I mean, you're located between Bulgakov, as it were, and the old historical center of Kiev on the hill, the historical museum, etc. Do you have a sense of history, of the history of that street and everything that's happened in that area, not just in the 19th and 20th centuries?
I'm very aware of it. And that was, you know, the chance to live and work in Andriivsky Uzviz has, you know, it was one of the perks. And that was really one of the reasons why I decided that this would be a nice thing to do for a change.
Okay, give us some idea of the kind of exhibitions, projects that you've been involved in with your gallery.
Well, last year we had 7 international projects. So we opened the year with an exhibition of Australian Aboriginal art, which was the first ever Australian art exhibition in independent Ukraine.
It was wonderful. I was there.
It was great fun, wasn't it? And, you know, a big thanks to Bruce Edwards and the Australian team for making it happen. And we closed the year with an exhibition of German artist Marcus Needon, who showed his Ukrainian diary. So he sort of sketched and painted 3 Ukrainian cities, Kiev, Lviv, and Odessa. And we actually have 2 exciting photography projects happening in March. On International Women's Day, the 8th of March, we're showing Mathilde Grafström's Female Beauty Project, which is a Danish feminist nude photography. So the female photographer, Mathilde, is showing women embracing their natural beauty in natural surroundings, because without self-acceptance, without really accepting and embracing your beauty, she believes that women can't truly achieve equality. Because men are confident, right? They're born to be outwardly confident, whereas I think women, especially women in Ukraine, set themselves to impossibly high standards.
Yes.
And the second project is something we're doing together with DocuDays International Human Rights Film Festival and the Swiss Embassy and the Week of French Language and Culture. And it's Looking for Lenin, a project by Niels Ackermann and Sebastian Gobert, which was the subject of a book published in the UK and in Switzerland last year that I contributed the opening essay to.
Well, you know, it sounds like you're really on the cutting edge and very much involved in the interaction with the outside world, particularly the European. What would you say about the state of play in the arts cultural world in Ukraine? Are we still trapped in a kind of provincial mode, or has Ukraine opened up to the outside world and become receptive to what's going on there?
Well, judging from the high level of international and internationally curated exhibits that the National Art Museum of Ukraine has seen, for instance, since the revolution, I can say that Ukraine as a country is generally moving in the right direction. So as we know, the NAMU, the National Art Museum of Ukraine, was barricaded during the revolution because the staff of the museum actually were under siege to protect the art. And since then, you know, they've brought in some really interesting exhibits, and they've worked increasingly with the extensive collection of the museum. So, for example, showing Soviet period art in a new educational critical context is something that I really believe in. And actually last year, which was, of course, the Russian Revolution centenary, or the Bolshevik coup centenary, I co-curated an exhibition at the University of Essex called Fallen, about Lenin's cult of personality, which actually featured some original socialist realist propaganda art alongside contemporary photographs and posters and artifacts.
And we've just had the big Boychukism exhibition in the Arsenal.
The Ukrainian
Center.
Avant-garde is something that has really been rediscovered as well. But of course, that is indivisible from what came after, namely Soviet propaganda. So really those two things have to be seen together. And it's too easy, I think, to just put certain aspects of art history and history at large under erasure and to say, no, we don't need that anymore. It's rubbish. Well, we don't need it, but we do. We need to learn from it so that we don't do it again.
Okay. And today, how would you assess state of the art scene in terms of the artists that are creating, not the exhibitions, not the exchanges with the outside world, but people actually creating here in this country, particularly in Kyiv?
There's a huge deal of talent. I would say one of the greatest advantages of Ukrainian art is the fantastic academic background that a lot of these artists are receiving from the vestiges of previous ages. This is something that has been lost a great deal in Western Europe. For example, the Glasgow Art School closed its famous sculpture department, which is really a shame because it's one of the last of the great European sculpture schools that we're losing. What I think needs to happen is education, art education in Ukraine has to really become more open to new ideas and to new influences.
People are traveling, so perhaps they are more exposed than ever before.
But unfortunately, young Ukrainian artists have to rely on foreign funding, both public and private, to actually develop themselves, to travel, to build themselves. It would be great, really, to see greater cultural exchange happening on an institutional level in Ukraine.
Well, I'm afraid, you know, our time is coming to an end, Miroslava. So how could we sum up? Let's sum up by your general feeling about where things are going. Are we just simply holding our own, or are we moving forward? Are you optimistic about what lies ahead in your sphere?
I'm very optimistic about the cultural sphere in Ukraine. Right now, we as Ukrainians are learning so much about ourselves. We're rediscovering unknown or virtually unknown pages in our cultural history. And we are also building domestic cultural production. So the film industry is booming. There is fantastic art being made. The music industry as well. There is so much happening in Ukrainian. And of course, I was initially rather skeptical about the radio quotas for Ukrainian because, you know, I used to think, well, music is music. Let's play good music rather than, you know, write music. But it's actually had a great systemic change. You know, I don't switch over to the next radio station when I hear, you know, a lot of the cool new Ukrainian bands that are playing. Feeling very optimistic. Obviously, you know, it's a sector that is under huge financial strain and that is also in transition. But I think, you know, we'll see really a hip, cool, new, young, and internationally attractive Ukrainian culture within the next 5 to 10 years, I'm sure.
Well, thank you. That's nice to finish on such an inspiring note. Thank you very much, Miroslava, for this fascinating talk with you, and I wish you every success in your endeavors here.
Thank you, Bogdan.
And for our music this week, there are three guys who live in Kryvyi Rih in central Ukraine, and they make music together. Roman Haman, Pavlo Pshaborovsky, and Vadim Dzundzia call their band Royal Kit. It comes from a Chinese emoji, and it's a bit of a play on words in Ukrainian because it can mean royal cat or piano cat. So when you listen to this song from their latest album, you might think you're listening to music from a very different part of Ukraine. It's called Bidakovati Gazda. For those of you who know the word gazda, you might guess what sort of sound this will be before you listen. Enjoy!
Нічого не вийде, як не лишусь ці горівки, пек до тебе прийде. Баба з девці не казала, ой, важі романе, ти лишись і кавалерки, йди лиш до Оксани. Ой, казав до мене дідя, будь це чоловіком, випій плюнься, мать обнись і закури судзигар. Ой, казав ми діду Юзик, будь це трохи темним, слухай, мамку, слухай, татка, пи не буй з темним. Oh,
Next week, we'll be back with more commentary on events in Ukraine, so tune in again for another edition of Ukraine Calling. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.